Stories of Our Times is changing.
The podcast is getting a new lick of paint, and we're expanding what we do. From the 19th of March, we'll have a new name, The Story. If you see The Story in your feed, that's us.
We'll still be telling one remarkable story in depth each day with agenda-setting journalism from Times and Sunday Times correspondents. And I'll be bringing you more original investigations that you won't hear anywhere else and reporting from around the world.
Plus, once a month, we have a special episode hosted by Times columnist and former Foreign Secretary William Hague. He'll sit down with a prominent newsmaker or big thinker to try and understand where the world is heading.
So look out for The Story from Tuesday the 19th of March with me, Manveen Rana.
And me, Luke Jones.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It might have been small, the size of a telephone box, but when the Odysseus lander arrived on the moon, it made history. The first commercially made lander on the moon ever, and the first time the US has touched down on Terra Luna for more than 50 years.
What we can confirm, without a doubt, is our equipment is on the surface of the moon, and we are transmitting. So, congratulations, IM team. We'll see how much more we can get from that.
This isn't the space race of old, the US and the Soviet Union sprinting to beat one another. The list of flags rushing to be planted has expanded no end, and even businesses are in on the game.
Russia launched its first moon landing spacecraft in nearly 50 years.
India has become the first country to reach the south pole of the moon and the fourth country to ever land on the moon.
China sent its youngest ever crew to its orbiting space station today as the country reiterated plans to put astronauts on the moon by the end of the decade.
Japan has made history as the fifth nation to successfully land on the moon.
So a new space race is afoot. But how do we share the lucrative prizes and avoid squabbling conflict?
The race for resources presents new challenges to a 56-year-old treaty that sets guidelines for international space exploration. Experts warn China's ambitions could lead to potential conflicts on the moon, but they also point out how cooperation between the U.S. and Russia led to construction of the International Space Station.
You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Luke Jones. Today, who owns the moon? And could it start a war on Earth?
I'm Professor Anthony Grayling. I'm the principal of the Northeastern University, London, and an author.
And author of a new book, Who Owns the Moon? His fascination with it goes right back to that first landing in July 1969.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground.
Yes, indeed, I can. I actually listened to it all happening, all the bleeps and the delays and the this is Houston and one small step for man and so on. Oh, yes, absolutely.
I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was tremendously exciting because it was a whole new frontier that had been crossed.
Beautiful view. Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here. Magnificent desolation.
And then forward wind to the present day, I mean, we've only recently had another attempt to put some machinery on the moon, the first time a private company's been involved doing it with NASA. Did you see any of that? What did you make of that all these years later?
Well, of course, I was very interested, not just in that, but all the attempts that have been made over the last few years to revisit the moon and find ways of ensuring that there are resources there that could be exploited. There is a very positive side to this, but I think that one also ought to consider some worst-case scenarios and prepare for them.
What is it specifically about the moon and not any of the planets or space in general that specifically seems to capture our imagination? There's something about the moon which has fascinated people, fascinated artists and writers for years.
Yes, the moon certainly does occupy a large part of the horizon of imagination for human beings. Because of its proximity, because of its changeable character, because of the associations that it has with all sorts of things, with the tides, with poetic evocations of the moon as something on which one can focus one's emotions and anxieties and hopes. But the truth is, of course, that the moon is very much a staging post for the rest of the near solar system and eventually the further solar system and then space itself. So it has this dual nature in a way. One aspect of it is that it is lodged in our thinking about what it is to be earthlings with this very near companion. But the other is that it's a stepping stone. And when you step onto a new platform, all sorts of other possibilities immediately begin to open up. And I mean, in the case of the moon, because it has water ice on it, it means that you can make rocket fuel there. And that means that you can facilitate further exploration, Mars, for example, and elsewhere.
Gosh, yes. For those that won't remember this, the fascination with the moon and the race to get there first was such an intense one. I mean, many will remember the names Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong in that original space race. Can you give us a flavour of what that time was like, why it was so frenetic and dramatic?
Well, there are two aspects to that. When Yuri Gagarin went round the Earth in 1961, he thereby established the then supremacy of the Soviet Union in space activity.
The space pilot, whom the Russians have deified as the man of the century, arrives at the airport outside of Moscow for his first public appearance as the crowds go wild over the first man to conquer space.
After all, the Soviet Union had been the first to put satellites in space. They put two up before the United States did it. And of course, this was part of the Cold War, my rocket is bigger than your rocket standoff. And that's why John F. Kennedy's wonderful speechwriters gave him that speech in which he said, we're going to put men on the moon before the end of this decade. And you may remember, he said, we're going to do it not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And when you do hard things, you grow. A wonderful remark.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It was very, very much a part of the Cold War race in general. If the Soviet Union could get to the moon before the United States, they might put weapons up there, they might test nuclear bombs up there and so on. So there was a real anxiety from that point of view. But for the general public, it was a quite different matter. For the general public, who had been coached and prepared by several decades of science fiction. This was, as it were, a fulfillment of a dream that had been engendered by all those science fiction possibilities. And I suppose to many people it felt like the next natural step for humankind.
And interestingly, in the book, you equate this to the scramble to colonize parts of Africa or Antarctica and the rest.
Well, I do that because the gold rush phenomenon in general, of which the scramble for Africa is an absolutely paradigm example, tells us, warns us, reminds us that when there are huge investments of money, of time, of effort and energy into the hope of getting a substantial return, that there's going to be competition, there's going to be haste, there are going to be mistakes and tragedies, but also there are going to be rivalries.
And competitions need rules. And that was achieved, at least in 1967, to an extent. What was that and why was it needed?
So what happened there was, in 1967, the United Nations managed to get an outer space treaty. In fact, that treaty was really driven by the US and the USSR, who were quite keen in a way to ensure that round the margins of the main Cold War standoffs, there wouldn't be unexpected things that might trigger a catastrophe. So we're going to say no nuclear testing there and no militarization. But that was pretty well the extent of it. Now, the United Nations treaties always say, let there be peace and progress and cooperation. Let's reserve things to science. If there are any benefits that accrue, let them be for the whole of humankind. And, you know, all those things are wonderful. They're aspirational,
yeah,
and they're not binding. That's part of the problem. But at any rate, this 1967 treaty was about trying to limit the possibilities on the margins of the Cold War of something unexpected happening. And that is why the treaty is so narrow in focus.
So the framework that we're currently working in, the international legal framework or basis of agreement, is broadly what it was in the late 60s. It's decades out of date.
Fundamentally, that is the case, yes. And it's not just simply a matter of being out of date. I mean, it's a good phrase, out of date, because, of course, in 1967, the things that are happening now were very remote and actually occupied the zone of science fiction. But also, there is something about the 1967 treaty which is independently worrying, and that is that the UN declared the moon is, in effect, a global public good, meaning it's anybody's who can get there to do what they like there other than things military. None of these things are anywhere near as good as a really solid international agreement, robust, enforceable, maybe with a space court so that complaints can be brought to it and adjudicated independently of those who've got a lot of money invested in it. But at the moment, the moon and everything that follows from the moon, it's a wild west. And this means that if you can get there, you know, if you're a billionaire maverick entrepreneur and you build rockets and you can get a big return from the resources on the moon, you're going to do it.
And that is one of the developments, isn't it, that we've seen since the late 60s, aside from the technological developments. It's the number of actors who can actually muster a force that could get them to the moon. It is not just the US and the Soviet Union anymore. It is many more countries and, as we've seen very recently, private companies even.
Yes, indeed. And it is the private enterprise aspect of it which adds weight to the concern. We see state actors like Japan, China, India, and the US are still fully involved. Russia, which hasn't done very much about the moon for decades, is now back in the game. NASA is planning to put people back on the moon within the next couple of years.
Artemis is different from anything humanity has ever embarked on before. And we will discover life-saving, earth-changing science and technology along the way.
But really, the players who are driving things, speeding things up here, are the private actors. Mm. It's the sort of individual billionaires with their entrepreneurial imaginations, but also private corporations. So we see the Odysseus landing a couple of weeks ago. That was a private company commissioned by NASA to put a module on the moon. And it, you know, 98% succeeded.
Houston, Odysseus has found his new home.
I know this was a nail biter, but we are on the surface and we are transmitting. And welcome to the moon.
So as the state gets smaller, private enterprise gets bigger, and they become much more significant actors in driving what happens in the future. How things evolve out there in space, with commercial activity in particular, is going to be, in effect, modeled by the choices of corporations and private individuals and not by international agreement.
In the past, we would have spoken of the US and Russia. Now we're talking about who, in terms of private companies, but also nation states as well. Who's leading the pack?
Well, the runners in this marathon are Japan, China, India, and the US in the form of a number of private companies who are working very hard and very fast to get their technologies in shape so that they can get there and then they can start operating up there. NASA has actually set up an operation for encouraging and supporting and commissioning from private companies this activity. So what NASA has done is, in effect, it has said, we're not going to do this through taxpayer money. It's not going to be a state enterprise. What we are going to do is to facilitate and support private enterprise. India and Japan, the same is true. China is a state actor. So you're looking at a kind of menu here, a repertoire of different agents. And by the way, also, the United States has set up this conglomerate of interested parties, sort of allied parties, under the Artemis Accords. So the Artemis Accords are a kind of framework for cooperation between the US and those of its allies which are space active and space ambitious, both the governments that are interested in seeing this happen and the private parties who are investing very heavily in it. But now China and Russia have initiated their own version of the Artemis Accords. And this is a reprise of the Cold War. It's just a reprise of a standoff.
Coming up, the moon is chock full of lucrative natural resources. Irresistible, therefore, for many of the world's richest private companies. Is this how some kind of lunar war begins? We'll get to that in a moment. This weekend, if you're a Time subscriber, you can catch the latest episode of Inside the Newsroom. It's our look at life here at the Times. It's our new behind-the-scenes series on Apple Podcasts, just for subscribers, on the Stories of Our Times feed. If you want to find out more, visit thetimes.co.uk/bonuspodcasts.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We are back on the moon with Professor A.C. Grayling. Getting to the moon has improved stratospherically since the 1969 moon landing. It's still very difficult and expensive, though. And if nation states are doing this partly for prestige, what is the motivator for private companies?
On the moon, there are mineral resources. So there are the obvious ones that we have on Earth, you know, iron and other kinds of ores that are extractable and separable. But there are also rare elements. Now, our modern technologies, our smartphones and, you know, LED and computing and, you know, all the equipment which is up there in the very congested orbital zone around Earth, they need these elements. They're in diminishing supply on Earth. There are some of them on the deep seabed, which is one new frontier for commercial activity, and they are up there on the moon. And in particular on the moon, there is water ice, especially at the south pole of the moon. And water ice is gold from the point of view of space, because you can separate hydrogen from oxygen, you can make rocket fuel, you can therefore make much easier and less expensively transits to Mars and to asteroids. Asteroids are rich in minerals as well. And mining asteroids will be one of the next steps, in fact, after the moon, even before Mars. In the last 25 years at least, hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, have been invested in getting to the moon and exploiting its resources. And people don't put that kind of money into these enterprises unless they expect a significant return.
So we have all this investment and excitement, and yet we have this creaky old legal framework that goes back to 1967 and hasn't really been updated since then. How does all of this work in the context of that?
There's this problem that in the 1967 treaty, it says, you know, nobody can claim sovereignty over the moon as a whole or any part of it. Well, the actors who put their equipment up there, even if they have unmanned mining equipment up there, able to extract stuff and payloaded back to Earth, they are going to want to assert a special interest in the area that they land in and operate in. You don't want somebody else's module landing so close by that it sandblasts your equipment or knocks it over or puts it out of action. When they do get up there and start getting to work up there, they're going to want to say, this is our area. The precedent for this is in the Antarctic. The Antarctic Treaty of 1961 says all the sovereignty claims that have been historically made about the Antarctic should be set to one side for the time being. In fact, they have been successfully. But now we see the Chinese have said that their research stations occupy what they want to have regarded as special interest zones for China, excluding other people. This is just another way of asserting sovereignty.
Yeah.
That will happen on the moon. Now, you see, when you do that and you start putting up borders and boundaries and making claims to territories and what have you, you potentiate the risk of conflict.
So to answer the question posed in the title of your book then, who owns the moon, put it bluntly, it's a game of finders keepers.
Well, at the moment it is, I'm afraid. The answer to the question, who owns the moon, is really we all do. And therefore we all have an interest in being part of the conversation about how things work out there.
Yeah.
You know, let's look at the benefits. There will be many, but then let's also try to see if there are ways of limiting the potential for difficulties, for conflict.
Mm. So we've little international agreement, really, that's binding. There's no space court that could adjudicate on disputes. It is a wild west. It's a new frontier. We know the prizes are enormous. The worry is, as you've already said, that this could lead to conflict, either here on Earth or in that arena in space on the moon. Before we get to that, currently, as things stand, how militarized a space is it, the moon?
At the moment, the moon is unmilitarized, but one can look at the analogy of the orbital zone around our planet.
Yeah.
Now, as everybody knows, it's incredibly congested. I mean, even your GPS that you use in your car as you're walking in the city is a function of whole constellations of satellites able to share information, triangulate, and so on. But amongst all this, of course, are surveillance and communication satellites that have military uses. And already the nations with an investment have developed anti-satellite weapons and systems for interfering with other people's satellite systems and so on. So the orbital zone is heavily militarized. And we saw during the last Trump presidency, the setting up of the United States Space Force with full representation on the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
It is not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space. So important. Very importantly, I'm hereby directing the Department of Defense and Pentagon to immediately begin the process necessary to establish a space force as the sixth branch of the armed forces. That's a big statement.
The manual of the Space Force, U.S. Space Force, it says space is a war-fighting zone. And one of the responsibilities of the Space Force is to enhance weapons and weapon systems and ways of delivering military necessities in space, and not just in the orbital zones. So already the major space-active nations are thinking about this as a place that has to be policed by military endeavor. But all trouble in space will rebound on Earth. You know, the wars that will be fought as a result of major interference by one party with another party on the moon will have their consequences down here on this planet. So we're exporting humanity's very bad habits. I think it will happen, when it does happen, far more quickly than we anticipate. You know, when I give talks about this matter, I start off by saying, look, the world is in a mess at the moment. And the natural question is, shouldn't we be focusing our energies on trying to resolve the disputes that we have now and the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine and so on? And my answer to that is, you know, these problems that are happening today would have been avoided if 20, 30 years ago we had thought about how we might try to avoid them. Naturally, of course, the UN and all the major states in the world have been trying to do that and obviously have failed. But nevertheless, if we had done it better, perhaps we could have minimized. So we ought to be thinking right now about what in 20, 30, 50 years' time might be happening out there on the moon or in space in general, and trying to put something in place that will really anticipate what the difficulties might be. But the problem here is that, you know, so many people are optimistic about all the benefits that will accrue, and they will be many. There's no question about it. I had a conversation recently, one party to which was the woman who chairs the United Nations Space Committee. They have a committee which monitors what's happening. It has no teeth. It has no enforceable mechanisms, but it kind of monitors what's happening in space, and it keeps on trying to encourage everybody to be nice. Her attitude was a very positive one. She said, oh, there are going to be so many good things. And generally speaking, both companies and states want to be seen to be good guys, and they don't want to cause trouble. And indeed, if you've got hundreds of billions of dollars invested, why would you want there to be conflict? It's just going to mess up your operations. But to take that point as a reason for not considering worst case scenarios and for not having a framework in place that would help us cope with trouble when it arises is a very serious mistake.
Yes. And is there a lower bar for more lethal conflict on the moon and in the space around it? I mean, we don't rush to nuclear weapons on Earth because we're worried about civilization, we're worried about collateral damage. In space, that risk is far lower, isn't it? On the moon, that risk is far lower. So when we read that Russia might be looking at extending its nuclear capability into the Earth's near orbit, should we be concerned that those weapons there are far more usable?
That's a very good point. And indeed, the answer is yes. Moreover, the development of weapons technologies, which are as devastating and in some ways more usable than nuclear weapons, laser weapons, used to be a science fiction possibility. Now it's a reality. And we know, for example, that the presence of AI in autonomous weapon systems is already now extremely advanced. We all actually live in the future without knowing that we do. So yes, weapons that we wouldn't use on Earth might very well be used in space.
You discussed what might need to form part of that kind of agreement and what the various issues are with bodies like the UN, where it might be agreed. Do you think one of the things holding us back from reaching that point is that it all still seems faintly ridiculous, the idea of going to the moon and doing these things, it seems still the work of science fiction. So how can you really properly bring it into a political debate?
People simply don't notice enough just how incredibly rapid technological development is. Take the example of ChatGPT. Before that was announced in November the year before last, people were thinking, well, the idea of artificial general intelligence seems to be so remote. It's not going to happen. AI is everywhere. It's running our electricity and our bank accounts and blah, blah. So, you know, it's perfectly harmless and it's going to be okay. And then suddenly something happens, which is a step change. And that's how technology works, because technology potentiates further technology. And sometimes you get to a kind of trigger point, you get a cascade effect of capacity which follows from a development. And we're sitting here in 2024 and we're looking at the current state of lunar landings. And people say, oh, well, I mean, so few and they're so feeble and really, can you imagine this? Well, I'm afraid I would not be surprised if in 10 years' time, mining hadn't begun by 2034. I think people make a very bad mistake if they don't say, let's prepare. Even if it doesn't happen, better to be prepared than not.
Yes. I'm worried that this conversation has all been quite doom and gloom. And I wonder if you could leave us with an optimistic note, maybe, on the good that could come out of all of this.
I do think there are a huge number of benefits that come out of any kind of new technological frontier being crossed. I talk about the effect on art and literature, philosophy, on how we see ourselves on Earth. When the first lunar orbits were made back in the 60s and photographs were taken of this beautiful little blue thing in the sky, people did have a sense of the fact that it is our joint home and that really we ought to behave better to one another and to it. And this, I think, will be reinforced. The more common it becomes to see ourselves from outside, the more there will be people moved to take the implications of that seriously. I wrote that book in order really to say, alongside all the positives, we really do ourselves a favor if we think ahead and we try to be rational about the prospects. Because human history loads us with far too many examples of how things go wrong. You know, the complacency that people feel today, even in the midst of all the conflicts we see around the world and the stresses and the horrible thought that we might be drifting to more general war in the world, that complacency is generated by the fact that most of us have lived in a very unusual period in history. From the end of the Second World War until, I don't know, you know, a decade ago or so, we lived through a time of relative peace and relative prosperity. 1.5 billion people around the planet were lifted out of poverty, the advances of medical technologies and so on. I mean, we've lived in a very, very unusual period. And the normal for our planet is trouble. And that is why we should think, okay, don't be too over-optimistic about how things will pan out in space. Let's put some stuff in place.
You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, a podcast brought to you thanks to subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times. With me, Luke Jones, and my guest, Principal of Northeastern University London, philosopher and author, Professor Anthony Grayling. He's also the author of the new book, Who Owns the Moon? If you're a subscriber, you can read more about the new race for the moon by our science editors, Tom Whipple and Ben Spencer. The producer today was Chris Wade. The executive producer was Kate Ford, and sound design was by Mao Lasseto. If you can, leave us a review, a nice one. Hopefully it'll help other people find us. You can contact us anytime, storiesofourtimes@thetimes.co.uk. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.